Winston current doesn't imply the Meissner effect, or I think it was that direct.
Yeah, yeah.
Can you just re-explain why that one doesn't imply?
Yes. Give you a trivial example. Take a free Fermi gas in an absolutely clean system. The if you shoot a current, it's not going to decay.
Okay.
But we don't want to call that a superconductor.
Okay. So it's just that's okay.
Because even experimentally, there are sometimes the measured resistivity in some region can be quite small, and then people may suspect that this is a superconductor. Because when rho is very small, it's sometimes hard to tell if it's actually zero.
Yeah.
And then it's always safer when people actually see Meissner effect. Then everybody agrees that it's a superconductor.
Okay, so we're just classifying a superconductor when we see the Meissner effect versus
yes.
Just, okay.
Okay, so tomorrow you have Lauren on XY model, oh yeah. Okay, so you finally learn XY model properly. So this is my last day to make you suffer, so I decided to talk about something cool. It's not gonna be tested in case. Right, so 2D topological superconductor. Eventually, I want to tell you something known as non-abelian anions. Just give you some flavor of what it is. Here's a list of references. It's it's listed in increasing order of length and completeness. I think this one is 5 or 4 pages. This one is 100 plus. Yeah, so depending on your taste, of course. So let's and today's lecture in some sense it's a review for you because it combines what you learned in band theory and in superconductivity. So let's start with a consider a BCS mean field Hamiltonian, but not quite BCS. It's BCS like. So you'll see the difference soon. In 2D, spinless fermions. 2D spinless fermion. So the Bogoliubov degens, whatever, Hamiltonian, the mean field Hamiltonian in momentum space looks like this. Ck, Ck dagger, Ck. And let's forget about Brillouin zone. Let's just do it in free space. So K lives in the two-dimensional plane, the infinite plane. Okay. And let's take this delta to be real. Then you have this term, e to the I theta minus K Ck plus e to the minus I theta Ck minus K. So let me explain. So where Ck is the standard kinetic term, k squared over 2m minus EF, the Fermi energy. Let me assume delta is real and much smaller than EF. And the meaning of theta is basically the direction of my momentum k. So if you like, e to the minus I theta or e to the I theta is defined as it's basically kx plus iky divided by the mod of k. As delta is much smaller than EF, this term only really matters near the Fermi surface. So don't worry about k equal to 0. Define it in whatever way. It doesn't really matter. So this is sometimes also known as the P minus IP, really means PX minus IPY pairing. Right. It's P wave because this phase factor changes sign if I switch K to minus K. So, or if you like, this is your Fermi surface, this is your K, then this is the theta. So let me comment that no material in the actual lab is known to have this kind of pairing for electrons. P minus IP pairing for electrons. However, this is not totally experimentally irrelevant, because this happens in a set of system known as some fractional quantum Hall effect. At a certain regime, essentially at something like the electron density over magnetic field equal to 5/2. This is also known as the 5/2. So this state is believed to have this. Not for the electrons, but for an emergent particle called composite fermion. So I won't say what it really is, except that it sort of exists.
Why only at a specific value of?
Yeah, the thing about fractional quantum Hall is every value of feeling fraction is a different state.
Okay.
Yeah, so 5/2 is special. And that's just a side comment. Just to tell you that this is not completely irrelevant. So now let's look at this Hamiltonian. And again, we forget about the fluctuation in delta, just treat delta as a constant and ask what does it do? Well, again, you can write the Hamiltonian as this. So let's rewrite this in the Nambu Skinner notation. But to avoid double counting, what you need is something like ky is takes any value, but kx takes only positive value to avoid double counting. Then you get this. Sorry, c minus k ck up to an additive constant, of course. Delta eta minus I theta. Delta eta I theta. So by now, this kind of thing should look somewhat familiar. So again, you have the eigenvalues are the eigenvalue of the Hamiltonian is plus minus square root of c squared plus delta squared. Let's call it plus minus ek. Okay. Or if you like, you can now rewrite this h again as requiring kx to be positive in the Bogoliubov basis. But there's a minus sign. What this really means is that very similar to what I showed you on Tuesday, except now this is in 2D, right? So if I plot, let's say if I fix a ky and plotting kx, I get something that looks like this. Okay. So this is a slightly weird space to work at, right? It's half of the momentum space, and there are some hole-like states which I'm supposed to fill, and the excitations correspond to unfill one of these holes. So then it's useful to define the antiparticle of this gamma k minus so that everything has positive energy. So let's do that. So we define gamma k as gamma k plus if kx is larger than zero and gamma minus k minus dagger if kx is smaller than zero. We're free to do that. So once we do that, the Hamiltonian becomes very simply Ek. Well, I'm using the fact that Ek is even under k going to minus k. Times gamma k, dagger gamma k. So these are standard manipulations with 2x2 matrices. So what that gives me this is energy momentum. I get something that looks like this. Okay. So it's all positive energy and scattered, right? This gap is delta, and this one is roughly EF. Of course, I can draw the other band in dashed line. So it's not a physical band anymore. It doesn't correspond to any physical excitation, except it's the remnant of this. Right? As I said last time, this gives you a redundancy, because you should really think of a hole here as equivalent, strictly equivalent, to a particle here. Right? So all your physical excitations should have positive energy. So now once I draw it this way, it actually looks pretty much the same as the S wave set. Yes?
Could you just write the explicit form of the function that you plotted there?
C is there. C is the k squared over 2m minus EF.
Is it different from the previous case?
Yeah, that exactly. It looks exactly the same as the original standard BCS dispersion. Right, now you ask what's the difference? Well, I have, of course, the trivial difference is that now these are spinless, so I have only half of the degree of freedom. But there are actually more. The thing is, dispersion looks the same. Dispersion really just means energy as a function of momentum looks the same as S wave. So what's the big deal about having this P minus IP pairing?
Can you explain more why is P wave?
Yeah, e to the I theta has angular momentum 1.
But the CC term will change the k to minus k, that is true.
Sorry, what?
The C minus k.
Yeah. So for example, so this summation contains both k and minus k. So now if you flip k to minus k, you get a minus sign here, but this gets another minus sign here. So they add, they don't cancel. That's required. For spinless, the pairing angular momentum has to be odd integer.
What do you mean not cancel? We have two minus signs.
No. There's a minus sign from this.
Yes.
There's a minus sign from exchanging k and minus k.
So
this means that the term with k and minus k are equal. They add.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And that's why for spinless, the pairing angular momentum has to be odd. Because it has to be odd. This factor has to be odd under k to minus k. So it can be e to the 3i theta and so on.
Okay.
Okay, so the dispersion is the same, but this really looks like a band theory problem now, right? Except this, think of this as two bands, right? You know, you've done something like this before. So dispersion looks the same as P wave, but the Bloch wave function may not look the same. In particular, the band may have a different topology. Now I have a 2D band. I can talk about Chern number. So we know that, well, you can not hard to see that for an S wave, the Chern number for that band is zero, basically because it has time reversal symmetry. This structure doesn't have time reversal symmetry. The time reversal symmetry will flip that e to the I theta to e to the minus I theta, because the imaginary factor I flips sign. So it turns out, I will show you soon, that this band actually has a non-trivial Chern number. So it's topologically distinct from the S-wave superconductor. So how do I show that? Well, this looks like a two-band problem. So you know how to calculate the Chern number for a two-band, thanks to your homework. But let me show you how to do that. It's slightly trickier because we know that only one of the band is actually physical. So the way to do that, let me just show you a trick. Essentially, let's use a redundant formulation. Essentially, we tentatively forget about the fact that only one of these two bands is physical. So we include both bands as degree of freedom, and at the very end of the day, we remember that only one of them is physical. So how do we do that? So we introduce a Nambu spinner, a two-component, essentially a two-component fermion, psi k, okay, defined for all k. Okay, so I no longer restrict my k to be kx to be positive, for example. Now I write h equal to essentially all k with psi k dagger c k minus k delta e to the minus I theta delta e to the I theta k. Let me also call this 2x2 matrix hk, so the algebra, the notation is simplified to this. So this HK is a 2x2 matrix as a function of momentum K. So you can say that if KX is positive, these are just my modes, my physical modes here. But now I extend the definition so that even KX equal to is negative is okay. So if I solve that spectrum, then the positive energy band will be exactly my physical energy band. And the negative one, let me just decide that it's unphysical, so let's not talk about it. So the formal way of talking about the redundancy is to say that, so let me first write up down here. So only half of psi k is physical. Okay. So the formal way to say that is to say that psi k is pretty much the same as psi minus k dagger, which is what we have here. Right. Except I allow a further basis change here. So this U is a 2x2 unitary matrix that can rotate between, in the two component. So what I can do is to pretend that this is the ordinary spinner at the beginning, and then at the very end of the day, I remember that psi k is essentially psi minus k dagger with a basis rotation. So if you do some algebra, let me not show you here. Essentially plug in this transform into this Hamiltonian and shuffle it. This requires that requires a certain relation between the U and the H what this requires is that u dagger hku equal to minus h minus k transpose. So it turns out this is the condition imposed by this redundant formulation.
So I have one new question. The phi k is a column vector, but phi k dagger is a row vector. So how can we connect the middle matrix?
Sorry? Oh, yeah. Okay. Sometimes people write this way. Yeah, let me write this way. Yes.
What are the subscripts on that u?
Yeah, sorry. U is a 2x2 unitary matrix. Okay. Essentially a basis change, basis rotation. And you can, if you play with this algebra a little bit, you realize that U is really just the poly X matrix. Turns out this form of U will do the job. We won't actually use the U later, so don't worry about that algebra. So all I'm telling you really is that you can pretend to actually solve a two-band problem like this. It's only at the very end of the day you have to remember that this band is not physical. For example, a particle here is really a part antiparticle here. That's all you need to keep track of. Okay. So, but this relation looks like some sort of symmetry requirement. So this in the literature is also known as the particle hole symmetry of a superconductor. But as you can see here, this is not really a symmetry. It's a redundancy, not a symmetry. As a result, this symmetry can never be spontaneously broken. But it does come with some consequence. Right? What's the consequence? The consequence is that whenever I have a mode with positive energy, necessarily I have another mode with the negative energy. It's almost a tautology, because that's what my redundancy does for me. Right? So let's say if this is my energy, this is zero, and then if I have a mode here, then I must have a mode here. Right. But then you realize that if I have a single mode at zero energy, at e equal to zero, this is the Majorana zero mode I talked about last time. So this is another way to see why it's stable. Because if I want to, let's say, change the Hamiltonian to move the energy of the mode from zero to some non-zero number, I don't know which way to move. Right? Any positive energy mode has to come with a negative energy mode. If I have a single zero energy mode, you know, it can't go to positive, it can't go to negative. So that's why it's always stable. So that's another way to see that the Majorana zero mode is stable. It doesn't know where to move. All right, so now let's go back to this 2x2 Hamiltonian H. So let me write HK. Write in your familiar form, it's CK sigma Z All right, let me write in the Pauli sigma xyz basis. Sorry, I think I got it signed wrong there. Plus delta cosine theta, you just expand that e to the I theta, sigma x plus delta sine theta, sigma y. If you remember your homework, this is your dz, dx, dy. And we know that, so suppose now let's compute the Chern number of the upper band. Upper band meaning the band with the with positive energy. So okay, let me say this is the dk plus sigma. So if you remember your homework, this is basically the winding number of this d vector on Bloch sphere. As I move, as I swipe through the entire momentum space, my d vector also winds on the Bloch sphere, and how many times it wraps around the Bloch sphere gives me the Chern number. So in your homework, you worked out the integral formula for that, you know, d dot partial d cross partial d. But here you don't actually need to do that integral. You can do the best kind of calculation in the world, which is calculation by staring. Because of this, so let's say you have ky, kx. So what does this d vector look like in momentum space, right? So deep down in the Fermi surface, as I assume that my Fermi energy is much larger than delta. So if I deep down in the Fermi surface, let's say this is my original Fermi surface. Right, so this is my kf, where kf squared over 2m is equal to the Fermi energy EF. Okay. So deep down here, I can forget about the delta. Essentially, I only have the xi. But deep down the Fermi surface, xi is largely negative. It's very negative. So what in terms of that d vector, it means it's essentially pointing toward the minus z direction. Okay. You're like, it's, let me say the minus z direction is this, right? So it's pointing like that. And of course, very away, far away from the Fermi C, out of the Fermi C, again, I forget about the delta, it's xi is very positive. So I have a d vector that's pointing toward the plus d direction. Right on the Fermi C, xi is zero. So only I have the delta term. But then you look at the d vector, it's the dx is cos delta cosine theta, dy is delta sine theta. So the d vector looks like this. So what does that look like? Well, if this is not simple enough, let me also notice that at infinitely far away, all the d vectors are pointing just toward the plus z direction. So essentially, I can think of the infinity as a point. I convert the plane to a sphere. Right? So once I wrap it into a sphere, let's say identify infinity as a point, then it looks like something like, let's say I define my origin as the south pole and the infinity as north pole. Okay. Then it looks like this, south pole pointing down, north pole pointing up. The equator, let me define the equator to be the Fermi surface. So then on the equator, it looks like this. And then what happens in between, you can see basically it's a one, you know, it's a simple identity mapping. Okay. The important thing is as I swipe through the entire momentum space, which is equivalent to swipe through the entire sphere, this d vector also swipes through the Bloch sphere exactly once. So this number is 1. By the way, this kind of configuration has a name. It's known as a hedgehog, for obvious reason. And then you can do the same calculation and realize that, it's a two-band problem. And you've shown in your homework that the lower band and upper band always have the opposite Chern number. So which means the lower band, even though it's unphysical, we can still talk about its Chern number. Has a Chern number minus 1. Yeah, so that's my promise. So even though the dispersion of this P-wave superconductor looks identical to the S-wave, the band topology is completely different. It has a non-zero Chern number. Okay. Any questions so far? Okay, good. So now what's the consequence of that? Non-zero Chern number, right? We don't have a U1 symmetry here. These are Bogoliubov quasi-particles, so we can't quite talk about Hall conductance. It doesn't make much sense. It turns out you can talk about thermal Hall conductance, but let me not do that for you. But instead, let's look at edge state. So you know that if I have a Chern band, it comes with some edge state. Yes.
I'm a little confused why we are considering this redundant band. Like, could we have arrived at the same conclusion without considering?
You could. The thing is, it makes the math slightly simpler. Right?
Okay. It's because we want to do a two-band.
Yeah, because you know how to do two-band.
Okay.
Right. In principle, what you can do is you just strictly work with this physical positive energy band. You also have some notion of Bloch wave function, right? CC dagger looks like, each eigenstate here, gamma, is a superposition of C and C dagger. So that's the analog of your Bloch wave function. And then once you have the Bloch wave function, you can define Berry curvature, Berry phase, Berry connection, Berry curvature, and then you can integrate the Berry curvature. But this redundant formulation has another advantage when you try to figure out the edge state. That's why I'm doing it, actually. So edge state. Okay, good. Okay, so edge state. So let's consider a disk geometry. So there's only one circular edge. So this, I have the P minus IP superconductor. Outside, I have the vacuum. So since I have some Chern band, I expect something like chiral fermion moving along the circular boundary. But what is that thing that's moving? So now let's go back to this redundant band structure. Okay. So remember, it looks like this. So the fact that the upper band has Chern number 1 and lower band has Chern number minus 1, at the level of band structure, right, from what you've learned, you should have a chiral fermion mode. So remember your homework. So this gives you a chiral fermion.
Do you have one regard each side?
I'm using a geometry where I have only one.
Oh, okay.
Just to make things simple. Of course, you can have two edge, and then it comes with pairs.
Mm-hmm.
But then you have to remember that I'm using a redundant formulation. Any negative energy state is unphysical. It's really the, you know, the whole of a positive energy state, right? Which means these modes are unphysical. But only the greater than zero modes are physical. But what does it really mean, right? So for a chiral fermion, you can write down, for example, a Hamiltonian. Let's say, suppose I have an actual integer quantum Hall state with U1 symmetry and so on. So there I can write down a chiral fermion, Hamiltonian, that basically looks like, let's tentatively call this Kx, even though if you like, it's like an angular momentum, some kind of momentum, right? Just tentatively, let's call it K. Then let me call the fermion chi. So then the Hamiltonian looks like this. Right? This is for an ordinary chiral fermion. Let me take the simplest dispersion where E is just K. Right? You can modify it in some non-essential way. It doesn't really matter. But now I have to remember that the negative energy modes are really the dagger of the positive energy modes. What does that mean? It means that I impose an additional condition beside the canonical fermion commutation and so on. I impose the fact that chi of minus k is the same as chi dagger of plus k. So this is the remnant of this particle hole redundancy here. Well, here you still have to worry about a 2x2 unitary matrix. There you don't, because this is only one mode, single mode. Right? There's no, it's a one-dimensional thing. There's no matrix to worry about. So this defines the chiral edge mode of my P minus IP superconductor. So what's special about imposing this? Well, it turns out this converts your fermion to a Majorana fermion for the following reason. Let's go to real space, and then you will see why I say that. So you can always take a Fourier transform. Is this chi obviously enough? You know, it's different from this x, right? It's, x is the real space coordinate. So this chi x, just by definition of Fourier transform, is something like dk over 2 pi e to the I kx chi k. There might be a minus sign. Let's not worry about that. But I've told you that minus k, chi at minus k is the same as chi dagger at plus k, which means this integral really becomes integral between 0 and infinity of e to the I kx chi k plus e to the minus I kx, originally it should be this, right? This is just a trivial rewriting. But now I remember that chi minus k is same as chi k dagger. So this is chi k dagger. But this is Hermitian, right? So this are the two complex conjugate. This is the dagger of that. So this is Hermitian. Or in another word, chi x equal to chi dagger x. And that's your definition of a Majorana fermion. Or, you know, if you like, real fermion. And the Hamiltonian in real space looks like chi I partial x chi. So this is also known as a chiral Majorana fermion. chiral because it only moves in one direction, right? The other chirality is missing.
So, sorry, can you explain more about the boundary conditions? What do you represent by the arrow?
Oh, the arrow is just saying the chiral Majorana fermion is only moving, for example, counterclockwise, right? Because it only, if you look at the velocity, it's strictly positive.
Yes. So why can't we have the other direction of chiral?
Oh, yeah. If you, for example, if I have another boundary here, then you have the other direction. Right. Remember your homework. Your homework was done on a cylinder, so it has two edge, one left moving, one right moving. Mm-hmm. But imagine shrinking one of the edge to nothing.
Oh. Okay.
Then that converts a cylinder to a disk, and then only the outer edge survives. Yeah, I mean you can always include the other edge, right? So this is the outer edge. You can always include an inner edge if, for example, if I'm on this geometry. Likewise, you have this. Yeah, you can do that. I'm focusing on only one edge. Okay, so let's take a 5-minute break, and then after that, I'll tell you what this means on the upper causal vortex that's superconducted.
We like the y-axis always zero, always positive.
Yes.
But also we observe the localization of the
yes.
on the other, like along the y dimension.
Yes.
Is there any relationship between these two?
Not necessarily.
So why I'll present.
Oh yeah, in this particular case, that's the case because
that he has been working on that. God knows how much.
And essentially, your bulk has a gap. Yeah. The thing is, once your bulk has a gap, any edge mode has to decay exponentially as you go to the bulk. Yeah. So yeah. For example, what you can do. Let's say you take a trivial insulator, forget about Chern insulator. Take a trivial insulator, and it's insulating, let's say it starts with insulating in the bulk and insulating on the edge. It's completely boring. But now suppose I put a metallic wire on top, a wire of gold or something. So there will be some tunneling induced by, you know, from the metallic wire to the insulator. So if you look at, you know, after they've coupled, if you look at the wave function of the gapless fermion in the metallic wire is still gapless, right?
Yes.
So what will happen is you will see that the wave function decays exponentially if you move into the bulk. Yeah, so the exponential decay is really a feature of having a gap bulk, while the chirality come from the topology of that.
Also, the question is that for the cylinder,
yes.
That we have some, add some K like this.
Yeah.
Add some K like this.
Then
we have this localization of the but if K is some other.
As long as you're not touching the bulk, they're all exponentially localized. Yes.
What if you have bank three or more edges?
What would it mean, three or more edges?
But you could do it. But it's been. You have to get your refinement.
Yeah. There's no problem with that. The count is this. whenever you go from, for example, this means that the bulk should always be on the left-hand side of the edge, which means here it should go this, here it should also go this.
So it's usually different.
Not really. Well, as long as each edge, they are far away enough, right? If they get too close, they start to couple, for example, and then they can scatter. What in that case you essentially get the reconstruct the edge.
Why always is it that edge mode can always be considered as chiral for me?
Okay.
At least for a segment, right? If you look at a small segment, it always look linear.
Linear, but the velocity is always positive, always negative.
No. For example, what you can have is this.
We can have this.
You can have this.
Okay.
Or you can even you can even have stuff like that and so on.
Okay.
So then in this case you have actually two right moving mode and one left moving mode. So it's the difference that's robust.
Okay.
Yeah. So this is just the straight line is just the simplest case.
Okay.
Yeah.
This U operator over here
is
charge conjugation and
Yeah. The thing is, when you do charge conjugation, you may need additional basis rotation to make it actual symmetry. Coupling with it some flavor matrix or even some gamma matrix and so on.
I don't know that much. I just remember reading, I was literally just reading this yesterday, talking about Majorana's and how you have to enforce the extra condition and the Lagrangian constraint.
anti-periodic boundary condition. So if you imagine having it, you know, in this geometry, kx can be thought of as angular momentum, for example. If it has anti-periodic boundary condition, then kx has to be 2n plus 1 over times pi over L. L is the length of the edge. Right, remember, if it's periodic, we say it's 2n pi over L. Right, if it's antiperiodic, antiperiodic simply means chi in real space at L is equal to minus chi at 0. Because these are Majorana fermions, they're real. So the boundary condition is either periodic or antiperiodic. You can't just multiply by some random phase here. Right? They are real Hermitian operators. So if you choose that boundary condition, then naturally your momentum is quantized in odd integer multiply of pi. So kx equal to 0 is not allowed. And then you get all the only positive and negative energy modes. So that's fine. But now, let's ask the question of what happens with a vortex? And that because of vortex, but now in 2D, so the vortex is really just a point. Let's say this is your superconductor, and now at the center, let's say, there is a vortex core, a metallic core, with that traps a magnetic flux, phi. Remember phi, the total magnetic flux trapped has to be a integer multiple of phi naught over 2. So let's think about the simplest one, where this n is 1. So let's think about having a phi naught over 2 flux. So
if you like, this is the pi flux, or in the standard unit, it's hc over 2e. So let's think about this vortex. Well, the thing is, once I have this vortex, once I have this vortex, the boundary condition on the edge will change. The reason is that if I have a flux here, the fermions moving on the boundary will see an Aharonov foam phase as I move along the boundary. Right? So the AB phase seen by the edge fermion is equal to the total flux trapped inside the vortex, which is pi. So now on top of the original antiperiodic boundary condition, my fermions see an additional phase of pi when it moves around the boundary, which means my edge fermion now have periodic boundary condition.
Why I don't like the way I have the antiperiodic boundary condition? Is that physical?
That has to be physical. I mean, that's the natural boundary. If you like, this is also the boundary condition, the natural boundary condition you choose when you do fermion path integration. That's the.
Oh, okay.
In pi.
Yeah.
You remember the Grassmann? The Grassmanns have antiperiodic.
Yes.
It's really the same argument there. If it's periodic, the kinetic term will give you zero mode, then your path integral is zero.
What is AB phase?
Sorry, Aharonov foam. It's really the Berry phase. The Berry phase coming from a charged particle moving around a magnetic flux is called a Aharonov foam phase. So, So now we have the problem or the feature. right? Previously, we say the natural boundary condition on the edge is antiperiodic, so kx equal to zero is not allowed, which means you don't have a zero energy moment. But now you do have periodic BC. So this chi, k equal to zero, becomes an allowed mode, which gives you a Majorana zero mode on the edge. But we said that the Majorana zero mode can never appear alone, right? It has to appear in pair. Otherwise, your Hilbert space, you'll be fine. So somewhere another Majorana zero mode should appear, which means another Majorana zero mode should appear somewhere. Any guess where it should appear? Yeah, that's the only place you can possibly do anything, right? So that's the statement. So at the vortex core, another Majorana zero mode has to appear. So in principle, you can actually see that explicitly. For example, you can put in a, let's say you're now putting a configuration with that delta, Fourier transform that into real space and put a configuration of delta corresponding to a vortex, and then solve that probability GN Hamiltonian in real space again. There you will find that there will appear a zero energy bound state at the vortex core. Yes?
Are they easier to measure as the 1D ones?
Sorry?
Are they easier to measure the Majorana mode?
They are much harder to measure than 1D.
Oh.
In fact, the 1D one has, essentially, if you want to measure the 1D chiral mode, the best thing to try is to measure thermal conductance. I didn't say this before, but if I have a mode that's moving in just one direction, that mode carries heat. So there will be some non-trivial thermal response to set up a temperature gradient, as you mentioned, current and so on. So there will be some response. That has been measured very recently, last year or 2 years ago. But still, people are arguing what the result means, blah, blah, blah. So, but at least we're close to actually measuring the 1D edge mode. The bulk, the vortex core zero mode, we're still very far away. I just recalled there's another experiment. I take that back. The vortex mode, there is another way to measure that by measuring essentially some kind of tunneling behavior. Because if I have a zero energy mode, say if I put an STM tip on top of it, there will be some tunneling behavior that's modified. And people are also close to actually being able to observe that. Yes?
If a Majorana fermion is real, doesn't that mean it's neutral? And if that's the case, how can it couple to the gauge field and see the effect of an Aharonov bomb?
Good, very good. So I was being lazy, essentially. What it really happens is that you can either view, there are two equivalent views. You can view this mode that is essentially coming from the microscopic electron, which has to see that Aharonov bomb phase, right? And in fact, the fact that Majorana is real means that it can only see a phase of plus minus one. That means this flux has to be some integer multiple of pi. That's actually another way to see flux quantization. So that's approach number one. Approach number two is you realize that you view the Majorana as literally charge neutral, which you can. That's known as the Bogoliubov fermion. And then what happens is that you recall that you don't see the flux, but then there's a vortex associated. The phase of the order parameter winds by 2 pi around the vortex, which means, but the order parameter carries charge 2, right? So each vortex should actually only see half of that phase winding, because each Majorana fermion, or each Bogoliubov fermion, because two Bogoliubov fermion couples to, the coupling is something like delta dagger, delta star, gamma, gamma, something like that, right? So when this phase winds by 2 pi, each of this gamma should wind by pi. So that's the other way to see it. So these two ways are equivalent, at least in the superconductor. All right, so so they are both measurable. So what I said wasn't entirely correct. Well, when I say the Majorana in the vortex is much harder to measure, I had some other thing in mind, which I'll tell you at the end. Actually, that's the next thing to say. All right. But let me say another way to see that you should have a Majorana zero mode appearing in the vortex core is to view the vortex as the inside, the interior of the vortex as not a vacuum. Because okay? Within the vortex, the superconducting order parameter goes to zero. Okay? So if I view this as a tiny little bit of vacuum, then I should have another edge mode here. Sorry, if my edge mode is moving here, then it's moving this direction. Okay. Except the difference is now this vacuum traps a flux of pi. So this tiny little, this tiny fermion should have periodic boundary condition. Right. So the fact that this region is tiny means that this L is not large. So momentum can be quite large and usually have very high energy. Right. So I can neglect that. Except the zero one, right? No matter how small L is, the zero one stays at zero, right? So if it's periodic, it's 2 m pi, and then zero is the solution. And that's where the zero energy mode comes from. So essentially, a pi vortex snaps an unpaired Majorana fermion. Of course, if I move this vortex very close to the boundary, then the boundary zero mode and the vortex zero mode can now mix, and the zero mode will be gone. But as long as my vortex is far away from the boundary, it's pretty much the same situation as the Kitai chain we talked about last time, as long as the left and right ends are sufficiently far away from each other, they're stable. Yes.
Is gamma like the xi? Gamma that you wrote
on? Oh yeah, gamma is like the xi. They're just different names for the. The thing is, I don't want to confuse this gamma with the. I don't want you to confuse this zero mode with the chiral Majorana moving on the edge. So let's call everything on the edge chi and call this trapped, essentially zero dimensional fermions gamma. All right, so finally, what does it do to for us? What's the, let me actually tell you the really cool part of the story. So now let's consider two such vortices. Far away from each other. Right, so essentially I have a vortex somewhere here with a Majorana zero mode gamma. Let me call this vortex one, so it's gamma one. And then far away there's a vortex here with a Majorana zero mode, let me call it gamma two. So, and then there's a superconducting background there. So if I neglect the superconductor, this looks pretty much like a Kitai chain. Right? You can imagine there's an imaginary Kitai chain linking them or something like that. Except we can manipulate this in a way that's harder for a 1D chain. As I told you last time, the funny thing about this is in this situation, there's a two-dimensional Hilbert space spanned by a state, a vacuum state, and a C tilde dagger state, where C tilde is defined as gamma 1 plus I gamma 2 up to some normalization factor. And C tilde gamma omega is 0. So that's the definition. So it's a two-state Hilbert space. And I told you that the information in this two-state Hilbert space, or this qubit, is robust because it's stored non-locally. It's essentially shared by this two far away Majorana zero mode. Somebody asked me last time that that also means that it's hard to manipulate this qubit. If I start from some state, I want to change it to a different state, it's going to be pretty hard. So today, let me show you one way to manipulate that in this case. So essentially, imagine you have the control of the position of the vortex. Practically, that's actually pretty damn hard, but in principle, you can do that. So take two vortex and now slowly move them by keeping them far away from each other. So what you can do is slowly move particles like this. Essentially exchange them. So for ordinary particle, let's say take your electron. If you do that, you get a sign, like a phase of, a very phase of minus sign, minus one. That's basically the fermion statistics one, up to some non-universal. For bosons, you get plus one. That's the bosonic statistics. Should that be the case here? You can ask. So first of all, there's one fact in two dimensions. That is, suppose I just hand you two particles. In general, the statistics does not have to be strictly either bosonic or fermionic. It's because this kind of path will not be contractible. Two dimension. In three dimension, if you do it twice, essentially let me also actually tell you the preliminary. So if I exchange twice, that's the equivalent of moving one particle around the other, topologically speaking. And in 3D, this path is contractible, right? If I'm in 3D space, this path can be deformed to this path, this path, this path, and then it's nothing. Which means in 3D, this has to be trivial. And that's why half of it, which is the exchange, can only give you at most a minus sign. That's where you get bosonic and fermionic statistics. But in 2D, this path is not contractible. If you try to contract this, this particle has to touch this particle, which can give you some singularity. Okay. So 2D, non-contractible. And therefore, exchange, which is like the square root of this, does not have to give you plus minus. Right. So if exchange gives you a phase factor that's not equal to plus minus one, this object is known as an abelian anion. This will appear, for example, in some kind of simple quantum hole, a fractional quantum hole effect. Let me not tell you where exactly it comes from. That takes another week to cover. However, we have an even weirder situation here. Because when I say the exchange gives you a phase, I'm assuming that the state itself doesn't change. Right? If the state itself doesn't change, at most you get a phase. Right? It can be some crazy phase, either I 2 pi over 3 or something, but still, it's a phase. But now we're having a two-state Hilbert space shared non-locally by these two objects. And because they are far away, these two states are degenerate. The same logic as the ground, the key type chain in open boundary condition has to be twofold degenerate. Which means if there is a degeneracy, then this, it doesn't even have to be a phase, it can be a matrix. And this is known as non-abelian statistics, or non-abelian algebra. So next I'm going to show you that this actually is an example of non-abelian algebra. So now let's think about this process and ask what is it? How do I actually figure out what's going on? And I exchange these two articles. I don't think I need this anymore. Essentially, remember that, as I said, the vortex, if I take a Bogoliubov particle around a vortex, there's a minus one that's picked up. There are different ways to understand that, but you reach that conclusion in any case. So that's also true for this Majorana theorem. Essentially, if I do twice of the exchange, which is equivalent to moving one vortex around the other, then this Majorana fermion, for example, it sees the vortex inside in the interior of the pot, so the Majorana fermion picks up a sign. And similarly for this one. So the way to formalize this is to say that I imagine each vortex comes with a branch count. So let's introduce a branch count. Associated with each vortex. So the rule is if my Majorana fermion or any Bogoliubov fermion moves across the cut, it picks up a minus sign. Okay. So the idea is if I have a vortex here, let me draw a branch cut here, and then if I have a fermion that moves across it, it picks up its sign. Exactly how I draw the branch cut doesn't really matter. I can draw it this way, I can draw it any other way, as long as I draw it somewhere. The reason that you need this is actually associated with the question someone just asked. Because this Majorana fermions, they're real. So they don't continuously rotate by a phase factor. You can't do like e to the I delta, e to the I 2 delta, and then gradually becomes minus 1. These are real objects. So they either pick up minus 1 or not. So the fact that they pick up a minus 1 after going around the vortex means that there's some kind of branch cut structure that's required. Okay. So the minus one has to come in discontinuously. So now let's think about two vortices. Now let's have a vortex with gamma 1. Let me say there's a vortex with gamma 2. So let me draw the branch cut this way. It doesn't really matter again how I draw it. Now I try to exchange these two. Right? So I try to move this gamma 1 to the gamma 2 here and try to move the gamma 2 to gamma 1 here. What does this become? Well, you need to keep track of the branch cut as you move, right? It doesn't matter how you draw it, but once you draw it, you better be consistent. So after the exchange process, what you will find is something like this. So you have gamma 2 here, but then gamma 1 is like doing this. See that? Do this, the branch cut will be dragged accordingly. So these are not exactly the same configuration. So in order to compare apple to apple, pair to pair, I better sort of recover the branch cut structure. So this will be equal to gamma 2, gamma 1. Right? So let me essentially move this branch cut across this gamma 2 and recover this configuration. But the rule is that whenever a branch cut moves across a gamma, that gamma picks up a sign, which means I should have minus gamma here. So now the effect of exchange is actually completely, not quite completely, but pretty much figured out by this. So the effect of exchange is that gamma 1 becomes minus gamma 2. Gamma 2 becomes gamma 1. And by the way, if you do it twice, you can check that gamma 1 becomes minus gamma 1, gamma 2 becomes minus gamma 2, which is just the picture here. Right? If I move this gamma around this vortex, this gamma should pick up a sign. And similarly, this gamma also looks like it moved around the vortex in its own reference frame, so that gamma should also pick up a sign. So this operation squares to something pretty simple. So this operation can be represented as a unitary operator, gamma 1, gamma 2. Right, so essentially what I'm saying is, let me call the exchange, give it a symbol, I don't know, E, let's say. Essentially, E acting on gamma 1 gives you minus gamma 2, acting on gamma 2 gives you gamma 1. So it looks like a unitary operator. What operator does that? Well, you can check that E is gamma 1, gamma 2. For example, gamma 1, gamma 2 times gamma 1. You can do a real-time check. Gamma 1. Well, if you change gamma 2, gamma 1, that gives you a minus 1. Gamma 1 squares to 1. So this gives you minus gamma 2. And likewise, gamma 1, gamma 2 times gamma 2, this 2 becomes 1, so this gives you gamma 1. But this is a non-trivial matrix in the two-dimensional Hilbert space spanned by this gamma 1 and gamma 2. It's not just a number, it's not just a sign. For example, let's see. Still have one. For example, let's go back to the C-tutor basis. Remember, consider this alpha omega plus beta C tilde dagger omega. Remember, C tilde dagger is something like gamma 1 minus gamma 2 over 2. Right, so these are the two states in the Hilbert space. So after this, so now you realize that the effect of the exchange is to convert this to well, gamma 1 becomes minus gamma 2, and then gamma 2 becomes gamma 1. If you look at this, this is minus I times C to the dagger. So which means, after the exchange, this state becomes alpha omega plus minus I beta C tilde dagger omega. Well, in general, this adiabatic process can give you also give you a phase factor. That we haven't figured out. I won't figure that out for you. But it's a phase factor. The thing is, this state is different from the original state. As long as both alpha and beta are non-zero. Right? If one of the alpha and beta is zero, then this differs from the original phase state only by a phase factor. Right? But as long as alpha beta is non-zero, it's a totally different state. So this is one way. So essentially, from the robustness of the Majorana zero mode, as long as the two forces are far away, we have robust quantum information storage. Essentially, I have some information in the qubit, basically what state I have in that two-dimensional Hilbert space. It's going to be robust. But then there is a way to manipulate it, at least partially, you know, do some kind of manipulation by just essentially moving, you know, slowly drag these vortices and move them around. Let's say do something like this and that. Just by doing this kind of what we call braiding, you can, you know, essentially change one state in this Hilbert space to another. Yes?
Does this have an influence on the surface tension between the two vertices then?
Okay. In this picture, I'm assuming the vortices are stable, which means it's type 2. I want type 2. Yes.
Sorry. But these two states only up to a like, classical beam, not quantum beam.
Well, it is a qubit. Well, in practice, if you want to do real quantum information processing, you have multiple of them.
Yes, yes. Right?
So let's say you have n even number of the zero modes of these vortices. What you will have is a 2 to the n over 2 dimensional Hilbert space.
Oh.
Now you do this exchange between these two, between these two, then you get a non-trivial matrix in this Hilbert space.
But I think the total possible number of manipulations is not exponential, but...
Right. Good. In fact, okay, so this thing of, you know, doing the, changing the state or manipulating the state by doing this kind of braiding is known as topological quantum computing. It's the basis of topological quantum computing. But it turns out this is the simplest example of non-abelian statistics, and it's somewhat too simple for you to actually do all the gates you want. It only does perform part of the gates. But still, this is it does something for you, not everything. So it's not enough for to do universal quantum computation. So that's it.
Hey guys, on behalf of the whole class, we'd like to thank you, Chan, for your great lectures teaching us so much about quantum matter. We have a t-shirt to make you an honorary scion.
Okay.